Support your curiosity by becoming a member of KCRW. That way you can help ensure KCRW music, news, and culture will continue to thrive and fulfill your need to know. Donate at kcrw.com/join.
Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
A mass shooting in California. Was it terrorism? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. A professional health inspector and his wife dropped their baby off at her grandmother's house yesterday in San Bernardino. Then they murdered 14 of his colleagues and injured 21 others at a holiday party before they were killed in a shootout with the police. The motive is still unclear, but there's no doubt there was prior planning. The FBI is leading a massive investigation. Terrorism is not being ruled out. We'll update that story, and we'll hear about law enforcement efforts to identify potential terrorists in this country before they can take any action. Investigators have to balance public safety and civil rights. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The latest toll from yesterday's mass shooting in San Bernardino, 14 dead and 21 wounded. The killers were a local health inspector and his wife, who left their six-month-old baby girl with her grandmother before arming themselves and attacking the husband's colleagues at a holiday party. Was it terrorism? Here's the FBI agent in charge at the scene, David Bowditch.
If you look at the amount of obvious pre-planning that went in, the amount of armaments that he had, the weapons and the ammunition, there was obviously a mission here. We know that. We do not know why. We don't know if this was the intended target or if there was something that triggered him to do this immediately. We just don't know. And again, that's going to take time for us to get to that answer.
Esbie Duprez is national reporter for Bloomberg News. She covered the Boston Marathon bombings and the mass shooting at Newtown, Connecticut as well. Thanks for being on our program.
Thank you.
Evidence says the FBI agent of pre-planning includes the amount of ammunition and weaponry this couple had. Tell us a bit more about that.
Right. There was an incredible amount of ammunition that these folks had. They had just rounds and rounds of bullets and guns. They had 12 more pipe bombs at the house where they were found. There was that one pipe bomb found in the Inland Regional Center where the shooting took place. They found tools in the shed to make more bombs. So really, these people were just incredibly well prepared to carry out a massively large scale attack, perhaps even larger than the one that we saw. So of course, there's 14 dead, 21 wounded. The scale could have been even bigger.
And they were dressed for the occasion.
They certainly were. They were dressed in tactical gear. They weren't wearing bulletproof vests, the police chief said today, but they were wearing some kind of tactical vest that allowed them to store more ammunition and more gear on their person. They had rented an SUV a couple days ago, and so that helped investigators find them as well. They had rented an SUV. It was full of ammo and just other ammunition that they could use when they got into that shootout with police yesterday, which ultimately led to their death. Like the FBI said, just incredibly well prepared here.
Esme Duprez with Bloomberg News. We'll come back to you in a moment. First, once again, the agent in charge, David Bowditch, was asked about terrorism. Here's what he had to say specifically about that question.
It would be irresponsible and premature of me to call this terrorism. The FBI defines terrorism very specifically, and we are still, that is the big question for us, is what is the motivation for this?
Eric Schmidt is senior writer covering terrorism and national security issues for The New York Times. Eric, good to have you on our show.
Hi, Warren.
What makes it terrorism?
Well, in this case, I think they're looking for some ideological motive, whether it be a domestic ideological focus or internationally developed. There's indications that Farouk traveled to Saudi Arabia at least twice over the last few years. His wife, who's a Pakistani national, is believed to have met him in Saudi Arabia. And either individually or together, they may have traveled back to Pakistan. Now, we don't know exactly what they were doing in Pakistan at this point. But the question is, did somewhere along the way they become radicalized so that they would have taken up some type of cause that would have been part of this mission? We don't know yet, as the agent in charge there said.
Syed Farouk was the man involved. He was the son of Pakistani immigrants. He was born in this country. He's an American citizen. Tashfeen Malik, his wife, was born in Pakistan. As you indicated, they met in Saudi Arabia, apparently. Do we know much more, Eric Schmidt, about than that?
We really don't. That's one of the areas that investigators are now digging into, is whether they met online, whether they met through friends, whether they met through some other network. And then from there, you know, what did they do when they were traveling together? And what would have brought them to this point in time where, as you mentioned before, they have a six-year-old daughter at home, and yet they are obviously had planned this attack out. And again, what are the motivations for this particular attack? It certainly has all the hallmarks of a terrorist attack, but it obviously happens in a workplace where there perhaps was some kind of dispute. So again, what triggered this? What was the intended target? Were there other targets involved? Those are the kind of things that investigators are still trying to get to the bottom of.
Farouk was at the holiday party and left. There were some indication that there might have been some sort of disruption or altercation there with somebody else, although there doesn't seem to be much evidence for that. NPR is now reporting that the FBI has asked counterterrorism agents to look into this. Does that, Eric Schmidt, suggest that they really do have strong suspicions, despite the very careful language we heard from David Bowditch?
Well, here's what they did. Once they had an identification of him, they run this through all their databases. In the U.S., since the 9/11 attacks have built up a massive database, not only on individuals, but then anybody they have come in connection to. So it's called network analysis. And so they are running his name against anybody else who he may come into contact. And at least according to our sources, he had reached out to a number of individuals, some extremist ties, and at least one individual who had been the subject of a counterterrorism investigation in the last few years. So, you know, these are things that that immediately got their antenna up at the FBI and counterterrorism agencies to see exactly what are his connections, who he's been talking to, what, again, might be the motivations for this. But that, again, is what's kind of brought this, as you look at the network and people that he was in contact with, as we learn more about his wife, who may have she have been in contact with, you know, who were they associated themselves with, and that might give us more insights into why they did what they did.
All right, Eric Schmidt, again, senior writer covering terrorism and national security issues for the New York Times. Thanks so much for being with us. We're going to be back in a moment with Esme Duprez and others as we continue to talk about yet another mass killing in the United States on To the Point from PRI.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point, once again talking about the latest incident of mass shooting in the United States, 355 or more of them so far in this year alone. Esme Duprez, back to you, national reporter for Bloomberg News, also covered the Boston Marathon bombing and the Newtown, Connecticut shootings. What can you tell us based on your experience about this situation and elaborate a bit more, if you will, about what do you think the investigators will be looking for?
Right. The FBI and other officials are doing the same things now that they did with the Sarnaya brothers Those were, of course, the masterminds behind the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013 and the killing of 26 at Newtown Elementary in Connecticut by Adam Lanza the year prior. You know, this is a pretty routine process. They'll comb through the history of this couple now that we have in San Bernardino. They'll talk to family, coworkers. They'll screen their online presences. Remember, when the Boston bombing Marathon bombing happened, there were those pictures from one of the Sarnaev brothers' online kind of Facebook account. It was I believe it was a Russian version of Facebook. And so they, you know, the investigators and journalists alike immediately went to that to kind of glean any clues about his friends, what he liked to do, you know, what he was interested in. So they'll be doing the same things here in this case. The FBI did tell us this morning that, you know, they're recovering cell phone and computer and thumb drive evidence from the house in Redlands where that shootout happened. They'll be looking at that very closely. They said digital media is incredibly important because we're trying to determine the motive here. Again, they can't rule anything out, but they were hoping that digital media will help really confirm, you know, what they think the motive and the inspiration behind this attack was.
Esme DuPrez with Bloomberg News. Mark Fallman is with us. He's National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones. He's focused on mass shootings and gun violence there. Thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
So there is a pattern then, and there is evidence left behind. But what about what is done ahead of time?
Well, you know, the many people who are thinking about this problem and trying to prevent these attacks from happening are, it's a really confounding problem because there are so many factors that play into this. And in a way, this case now in San Bernardino is, in some ways, it appears to be new in the way that it conflates potential workplace violence with potential terrorism. We don't yet know really what's behind the, in terms of the motive, but clearly this was a very deliberately planned attack. And that's a really important point with all of these public mass shootings of varying motive and ideology, is that they are targeted violence. There's a myth about mass shooters that they, you know, quote, snap, and that's not what happens. This is not an impulsive crime. The vast majority of these crimes are planned for days, weeks, months, or even years. There's a lot of forensic evidence of that now.
Apparently, as far as the workplace is concerned, people said this was a quiet man. He was not known for any kinds of evidence of emotional difficulties. There was a fragmentary kind of report about some problem at the holiday party. But again, all of the pre-planning would suggest that this was not some sort of spur-of-the-moment thing.
Right. Investigators do look for potential triggering events, which is different from saying they snapped, meaning something happens that essentially sets their plan in motion that they've been planning for however long prior to that moment. So it may be that some workplace dispute set off this attack. We don't know. But it is part of a very complex web of factors that go into trying to figure out who might do this. It's essentially impossible to predict. But we do know that there are some patterns in these types of attacks, too, in terms of the weapons used. The vast majority of them are obtained legally in these mass shootings, as is the case again here. And one interesting thing I heard talking with a federal official a couple days ago, who's very focused on this problem, said to me that, in the wake of an event like what happened in Paris, all of the people that they are concerned about in terms of a threat of targeted violence or a potential mass shooting, regardless of what the ideology may be or the motive may be, all of those people get spun up, is the word, the phrase that he used, meaning the threat grows because there's a greater sense that this is a viable thing to do. There's the copycat factor that plays into that, and it's a certain kind of vicious cycle that seems to be playing out.
Here's what President Obama had to say today in the Oval Office as he was beginning a meeting with his cabinet.
It's going to be important for all of us, including our legislatures, to see what we can do to make sure that when individuals decide that they want to do somebody harm, we're making it a little harder for them to do it, because right now it's just too easy.
Esme DuPrez, back to you with Bloomberg News. That suggests that the president is talking about making it more difficult for people to obtain weapons. Is there any indication in Washington at the moment that there's movement in that direction?
I would, if I was a betting woman, I would bet against the likelihood of that happening. There just is not the support, bipartisan support, to pass tighter gun restrictions. What we've seen certainly from history would tell us that that's very hard to do. Following the Newtown shooting in 2012, there was that massive, one of the most significant attempts to tighten gun regulations, and that didn't work. So I don't know that people should feel necessarily extremely hopeful right now that things have changed. Certainly Democrats want that to be the case. They President Obama was one of many Democrats yesterday to come out immediately and say, we need to have tighter gun restrictions. But the Republican Party stands firmly against that. It's also just interesting to note, California has some of the strictest gun laws in the nation. So that really speaks to the fact that, a federal law is what they're after. These state-by-state, patchwork of laws really isn't necessarily very helpful or as helpful as it could be, as federal legislation could be, because these guns were illegal here, in the San Bernardino shooting. They were purchased legally, they were registered, and so the fact that people could just take them across state lines really points to the need for federal legislation, as supporters of that see it.
Again, Syed Farouk and Tashfeen, his wife, Tashfeen Malik, his wife, are both of Pakistani descent. He, of course, born in the United States. She, an emigre from Saudi Arabia, from Pakistan through Saudi Arabia. Both of them are Muslims. Jihad Turk is president of the Bayan Claremont Islamic Graduate School. He's former director of the religious affairs at the Islamic Center of Southern California. That's the oldest and largest mosque in Southern California. Thank you, as always, for joining our program.
It's my pleasure, Warren.
Are you concerned about a backlash?
Yeah, in fact, I just got off the phone with Deputy Chief Mike Downing from the Los Angeles Police Department, and he's actually holding a press conference with local Muslim leaders as we speak, a phone conference, rather, with them. But I spoke to him before that just to catch up to speed on what the situation is, and he's already reported that there's been a number of hate incidents, here in Southern California. There was something that happened in North Hollywood Mosque. There's been some hate messages at the Islamic Center of Southern California. And even last week before this, just in response to most probably the Paris attacks, there was a bullet-ridden Quran that was left at a mosque in Orange County.
We talk about terrorism. It would seem to me this is a sort of reverse terrorism, if you will, because of the fear that Muslims must have about exactly the kind of thing you've just described.
Well, I mean, the challenging part for our community is that, number one, we're victims of this act of terrorism, if that's what it ends up being, or this act of violence, if nothing else. One of the victims there is a member of our community. Her name is Annie Kandakar, and she was shot three times. She's survived, and she's one of the wounded. She was literally a victim of the attack, and a colleague and a coworker of the attacker. I inquired with local imams here in Southern California, does anyone know this guy? And I was able to find a community that he used to tangentially go to just once in a while in Riverside, but he stopped showing up just over a year ago, probably around the same time that he came with his wife from overseas. And so he's not really an active member of the local community. People didn't know him. And I just talked to the president of that mosque who'd been there for many years. He said he's never met him personally. So he wasn't an active member of the community. And that's really the challenge, is that these people are often on the periphery of the community and they're not being radicalized in the community. And Chief Downing shared with me that he said now more than ever, we need the Muslim American community to help identify individuals that might be at risk for some kind of violent attack.
Do you think they'll get the cooperation that they're asking?
Absolutely. In fact, I talked with many of the local leaders here. Many are on the phone with the chief right now. But, I think without question, the American Muslim community, that those that attend mosques and the institutions here, we cooperate with law enforcement, and law enforcement sees us as allies, really on the front lines of helping to secure our country. And so, you know, they turn to us, we turn to them. We have a very good relationship. We're a very cooperative relationship, and we rely on them to protect our community from backlash. But they also look to us to help be supportive in trying to prevent any kind of attacks that might be committed by individuals who are espousing some kind of alarmist or extremist rhetoric within these institutions. And it was for that reason that earlier this year, President Obama had invited a number of us here, including myself, to the White House to a summit on countering violent extremism because, you know, we're really looking at a way to create resilient communities here, to identify people who are at risk, usually people who, and I don't know if you read the LA Times article that just came out with the backstory of this guy's family life and his upbringing in a very turbulent family environment that had domestic violence and alcoholic father and other things. You know, people who are at risk, they have this kind of emotional instability or some other kind of what the intelligence community calls a cognitive opening that makes them at risk for being, you know, someone who would commit violent extremist and a violent act of terrorism. And you know, they might have a legitimate or perceived grievance of something to do with American foreign policy or whatever their issue is, but it's that mental instability, emotional instability that is really the opening for that. And so anything that we can do as a community, and we're really, and that's what we do here at Bayonne Claremont, is we train religious leaders and scholars to be able to identify people who can, you know, who are showing signs of being at risk and to intervene.
Mark Fullman, back to you, National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones Magazine. We talked about 355 or more mass shootings as defined by the FBI. Are they more or less likely to be committed by Muslims, or do other people commit more?
You know, I have to say first that there's a problem. I have a problem with that number that's flying around all over the place since yesterday, about 355 mass shootings this year. I'm actually going to have a piece coming out about this very soon. You know, it's a matter of criteria, the kind of attacks we're talking about. And obviously, we have not had that many attacks like what happened yesterday this year. Those numbers are coming from a source that conflates all types of crimes and is using a lower baseline in terms of the casualties. But, you know, in terms of the people who commit these types of public mass shootings and the question about Muslims, in a word, no. The majority of public mass shootings of this kind tend to be carried out by white males. Now, that said, we don't know yet if this is a terrorism case, and there are some really interesting questions even about using that terminology that everyone is debating now. So, you know, if this was inspired by ideology having to do with the conflicts in the Middle East, et cetera, we might look at it differently in terms of what happened. But generally, with these types of acts of gun violence that we've seen in public venues, no, they haven't been cases like this. They've generally been carried out by young to early adult white males.
Esmé Duprez, very quickly, with the few seconds we have left with Bloomberg News, do you disagree as well as Mark Fullman does with this very large number that's called a terrorist act?
Right. It is hard to say. Like Mark said, you know, the definition can change depending on who's giving it. So I would certainly agree with him. We've been calling it the second mass attack in less than a week, obviously following that Colorado shooting at the Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs.
Okay.
So it really depends on your definition.
All right. I want to thank Mark Fullman with Mother Jones Magazine, Jihad Turk at the Bayonne Claremont Islamic Graduate School for being with us. So we're going to continue this conversation in a moment. We'll talk a bit about a bit more than we have about the effort to find potential terrorists in the United States at the same time protecting civil liberties. This is To the Point from PRI.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, once again talking about the shooting yesterday in San Bernardino by Syed Farouk and Tashfeen Malik, a married couple. He, a American-born person of Pakistani descent, she, a Pakistani who was came to this country under a fiancé. A visa. Both of them were killed by police after they murdered 14 people, his former colleagues in the health department, and injured 21 more. Esme Duprez, still with us, national reporter for Bloomberg News. There's been a report recently by George Washington University about the efforts that are being made to try to track down and prevent people from committing incidents of this kind, crimes of this kind. Tell us about it, if you will.
This report came out just this week, very interesting, again, from George Washington University, like you said. What it found, it really looked at the profile of a typical ISIS recruit. And obviously, as you might imagine, there is not one set profile. There's no typical recruit. But what they did find was that ISIS recruits tend to be younger than previous terrorism suspects. The average age was 26. The vast majority of them were U.S. citizens or permanent residents. So these were not foreign infiltrators. This really underscores the threat of this homegrown danger, perhaps like what we saw in San Bernardino. A lot of them were converts to Islam, and most of them were male, but women were playing a bigger role than before. So one researcher, just speaking to the fact that there's no set profile of these people, they said, you know, called the diversity staggering. What another interesting finding in how they actually, you know, determined who these people were, they looked at social media, and they just found that social media plays such a crucial role in the radicalization of these folks, particularly Twitter.
And we heard that the FBI apparently has already shipped iPhones and computers and other such things, digital communications equipment, back to Washington for analysis at the FBI labs. So evidence that comes out of those, I take it then, will be very important.
They did, right. The FBI told us this morning that they expedited some of that evidence to D.C. to get a read on what it can tell us as soon as possible. They also flew in a team from D.C. today to reenact some of the crime scenes, so we'll be learning more about that. They also said that they were looking at the level of sophistication. Remember, there was that pipe bomb found inside the Inland Regional Center where the shooting took place. It was connected to some kind of remote control car, and they talked about the level of sophistication of that device. They were talking about, you know, that's a level of sophistication that, you know, is greater than we might, you know, see elsewhere. They said they were looking into connections with designs published in that Inspire magazine. It's an Al-Qaeda-linked magazine that publishes. I actually haven't looked at the magazine in particular, but have read about it, and they said that they publish recipes for bomb making and just other kind of ways for again people at their homes basically to recreate what Al-Qaeda and other terrorists have recreated on the battlefield. So they're going to be looking into whether there's any connection to that.
On the other hand, you can get such information from survivalist guides and other such places and have been able to do that for many, many years. I think it's very important to point out that whereas the George Washington study was done about ISIS recruits very specifically, nobody has used the term ISIS in association with this. They haven't even said that this is a case of what they define by the FBI in their very specific way as terrorism. So it seems to me, Esme Duprez, we do need to be careful about conflating these two things.
Absolutely. And these are just questions we're going through right now. We don't have answers. And officials have been very careful about that. They've said, look, we're looking into all the possible motives and inspiration for this, but we're not ruling out anything, but we're certainly not saying this is a link to terrorism. It's just too early to tell. Remember, it's 11:30 in Pacific time right now. I mean, this attack happened just 24 hours ago. So we are really, you know, we're going to get a lot of more information as time goes on.
Story that has developed with extraordinary speed. We found out an awful lot just in that very short period of time.
We have, absolutely. And remember, the suspects, they were even, you know, there was some concern yesterday at a press conference in the afternoon about the suspects still being on the loose. And then, you know, immediately we heard of this gun battle that was being engaged on the streets of San Bernardino in a very residential neighborhood. And we saw pictures on the television of that happening, you know, yesterday afternoon while it was still daylight out. So police moved and investigators moved very quickly on this case. They found who they were looking for. Now the question is just piecing together who these people were. One thought, one one point I wanted to make was the police chief this morning said they had been interviewing family members of this couple, which was interesting that they were cooperating with that, and they were looking for more family members to interview, and as well as coworkers, you know, just everyone who knew these people.
A lot of cooperation from the Islamic community or the Muslim community, as we heard earlier from Jihad. Tariq Esmi Duprez with Bloomberg News covered the Boston Marathon and the Newtown, Connecticut shootings as well. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Warren.
William Braniff is executive director of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland. He's an expert on countering violent extremism. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tell us, if you will, what you can about this current incident, and what about this study by George Washington University? What exactly is being done to try to find people before incidents like this occur?
Well, I don't have much to offer on the current state of events with respect to this one attack. I think that I would just be repeating what we've all heard.
Sure.
In terms of the general posture of the counterterrorism community, I mean, you know, there's multiple things happening. We just heard a great example of the tremendous work that Chief Downing is doing in L.A., and I'm so glad you had Jihad Turk on the phone. That kind of trust-building work that you do before an attack happens is essential. You build those lines of communication, that trust. The Muslim community knows that Chief Downing is going to make sure that he's protecting them from backlash attacks, which statistically speaking are likely after an event like this. And the community is you know, rallying behind the law enforcement community as members of the American fabric. That's an essential part of that's the foundation of countering violent extremism work. It's building trust and communication. Beyond that, however, right, there is a threat that has grown in the United States and abroad, especially abroad, largely due to the growth of ISIS and the increasing level of lethality of groups like ISIS and those that it competes with, like the Al-Qaeda and its associated movement. And a lot of the counterterrorism game happens online now, because that's where most of the communication happens within a geographically distributed terrorist movement. So the law enforcement community goes where the adversary is planning, plotting, recruiting, and this, you know, raises some really important questions about that line between effective counterterrorism, legal counterterrorism, and protecting civil rights and civil liberties.
There have been horror stories printed, I think that's a good name for them, about situations where, in fact, people have been or appear to have been lured into doing things that they might not have done otherwise by investigators who were listening to their communications or monitoring their communications in one way or another, and then persuaded them to take actions for which they were then arrested and presumably might be prosecuted. How do you avoid doing that?
Well, this is a central dilemma. You have a tool that is sort of tried and true in the criminal justice system, the use of informants, the use of confidential or undercover agents. This is something that we have sort of rules and regulations about and that are exposed to scrutiny during a trial to make sure that the norms have not been exceeded. But when you're talking about an adversary that's interested in using easily obtained weapons to attack soft targets, it's different than putting an informant into a organized crime ring. The law enforcement community wants to maintain positive control of that situation. They don't want to let this individual obtain weapons or explosives on their own or any other easily obtained weapons. And so this puts a pressure on them to engage in these kinds of sting operations because the number of plots has increased, the perception of the threat has increased, and they don't feel like they have the ability to sort of play it hands off. But they, you know, eventually we need to make sure that they're being held accountable in the courtroom and otherwise, and making sure that they're not exceeding their mandate.
Bahar Azmi is with us, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, former professor of constitutional law at Seton Hall University School of Law. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What are the lines that need to be drawn in this context, given the constitutional protection for free speech?
Well, I think there are a number of them. One, of course, is that, you know, we have broad First Amendment protections for speech, political speech, even controversial speech. So individuals are constitutionally entitled to make provocative statements in support of certain causes or criticizing the U.S. government foreign policy, and that in itself is not criminal, even if it might raise the eye of law enforcement about potential action down the line. I think the other line to be worried about is I do fear that law enforcement is trying to develop a kind of standard profile of who might ultimately become an extremist and try and intervene early in this, imagined process of radicalization. But the process is not uniform or predictable. And so another risk is that, you know, law enforcement uses certain indicia like political speech or criticism of the government or just merely more aggressive religious behavior or religious interest as a proxy for criminal suspicion. And I think we should all be careful about that as well.
Let me introduce Dr. Yasir Khadi, who is professor of Islamic studies at Rhodes College. He's also a nationally renowned Muslim cleric. Thank you so much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Do you know situations of the sort we've just heard described where it appears law enforcement went too far?
Yes, actually, a number of circumstances, a number of cases have occurred where a young man, typically a man, is basically expressing discontent in foreign policy, getting angry at drones at Guantanamo, and this is taken as some type of danger sign that this person might potentially become radical. And so the FBI swoops in and basically entangles this person in an elaborate scheme, sometimes spending millions of dollars and perhaps up to a year or two, where people befriend this young man, take him to various places, ask him to purchase things, and then tell him how to construct. And all along, this young kid is basically mentored into becoming a terrorist by FBI agents. And in fact, there's a really good book that a researcher has done by the name of Trevor Aronson, in which he basically talks about how the FBI is so great at stopping its own plots. And according to his statistics, around 93% of the terrorist plots that the FBI says they've thwarted actually emanate from within the FBI, i.e. the entrapment schemes. So it's not just an ineffective wastage of our resources. It's also counterproductive because that doesn't really solve actual radicalization.
William Braniff, back to you with the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. That must be law enforcement's, or it ought to be, law enforcement's worst nightmare, and yet we're hearing that it happens fairly frequently.
Well, I think there's a difference between entrapment and effective use of undercovers that abides by the laws of the land and that stands up in court, and I don't have insight into what percentage of that, those 93, the 93% of those cases would have crossed a line or might have crossed a line. I'm certainly no fan of entrapment and would never argue that that's, a good use of resources or an ethical use of resources. But I don't know that because it happens on occasion, it should mean that all the other cases are examples of entrapment. And I don't really want to sort of debate that issue. I don't have any real insight into that other than sort of what I've outlined before. It's certainly counterproductive. There's no doubt in my mind that it's counterproductive if the government can't demonstrate that they're using these tactics ethically, effectively, and that they demonstrate competence so that the American community, including the Muslim American community, has confidence and faith that the law enforcement community is protecting them. If the perception that these is that these tactics are unethical, then we do have a problem in the criminal justice system, because terrorism and counterterrorism is ultimately about the legitimacy of the government and the law enforcement community in the eyes of the constituency. if a given person thinks that ISIL or Al-Qaeda has greater legitimacy than their local police department, then we have a problem. And so, you know, I don't think any of us have enough insight into the universe of cases to say that the tactic is always or is sometimes, is always or is never a problem, and I wouldn't have that debate. But the perception is a central issue if we're really going to be effective at counterterrorism.
There have been, as I understand it, 56 arrests of people who were described as ISIS supporters in the United States in this year alone. Do you know, William Braniff, what kinds of crimes they were charged with? What did they do?
This is really interesting. Because of the number of investigations, Director Comey cited 900 investigations in all 50 states, there's this pressure on the law enforcement community to conduct an intervention earlier in a conspiracy than they might otherwise if they didn't feel that burden of that caseload. And what this means is I think many of the charges being directed against these individuals are for things like material support for a designated terrorist organization. That's a federal crime. Something like joining ISIL or Al-Qaeda is a federal crime because you're giving your body to that organization. You're giving them some material support, as well as financing or other kinds of support short of personally engaging in violence. And the challenge for us as a nation, I think, is that while these people have broken a federal law and a serious federal law, when they're a minor or someone who is not engaged in serious violent criminality themselves, we're putting that in front of a judge and asking a judge to sentence, and that's a very difficult decision. How long do I sentence this person? Is that enough to put them away for 20 or 30 years? These are difficult questions for a judge, and the problem is that there's no real alternative to the criminal justice system in place. There are wonderful NGOs doing their best to try to provide an off-ramp or to conduct interventions. There are a few doing rehab and reintegration, but that's a real area, I think, where we can improve as a country. Can we carve out enough space so that NGOs can either do an intervention ahead of time and not be afraid of being accused of being complicit if something goes wrong, or enough space to do rehab and reintegration work after a short prison sentence so that someone can be returned to be a productive member of society? And those are really challenging issues, but really important ones.
Dr. Qadi, back to you. You're representing the Muslim community for the moment on this program. The question of perception was raised by Mr. Braniff. You certainly must understand why it is that the public would want to see prevention rather than allowing things of this kind to happen. What sort of limits do you want to see on the tools that investigators can use?
Well, the American Muslim community is even more concerned about domestic terrorism than any other community. And that's because, firstly, we suffer, the casualties are the same. We are a part of America, and anytime something happens, we also get hurt or killed. I mean, there was a victim in the shooting yesterday, Ms. Kandakar, who was shot, I think, 5 times, and she's now in the hospital. And she's a part of the mosque community, and she was actually shot. So she's actually a victim. And Muslims, American Muslims, also have to suffer the backlash of what happens after such terrorist attacks. So we want to ask the broader public to understand that the best allies, the most effective allies against actual bona fide radicalism and terrorism is the American Muslim community. And we're not asking for any special treatment. We want to be treated fairly and squarely like every other ethnicity, like every other religion, like every other minority. So, for example, we don't want to be profiled or stereotyped just like any other community is not profiled or stereotyped. If the profile of the average mass shooter is a young white Caucasian male, and nobody is going to profile a white Caucasian male coming from a Christian background. If the profile of the shooter of the abortion clinic was a pro-life person, and nobody is going to profile all pro-life people, well then we as American Muslims ask for the exact same dignity, the exact same freedoms that everybody else has. Simply because an American Muslim disagrees with any policy, domestic or foreign, and they get angry at that foreign policy, does not in any way make them more susceptible to terrorism or violence. Just like if a Christian disagrees with abortion, doesn't make them any more susceptible to go kill a person of the Planned Parenthood. So we're not asking for anything special.
We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back and continue this conversation in the aftermath of the shooting yesterday in San Bernardino, California. This is To the Point from PRI.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Well, not only back with To The Point, once again, in the aftermath of yesterday's shooting, we are talking about a much broader subject, and nobody yet has associated that incident with the investigation of ISIS, which is the subject of our current, or people might, who might be associated with ISIS, the subject of our current conversation, although the thematically, obviously, there is a connection. Bahar Azmi, back to you, our legal director for the Center of Constitutional Rights. Tremendous pressure, as Mr. Braniff said, on investigators to be, as you indicated yourself, able to predict what might happen and prevent it in advance. Is that even possible under the law?
I think it's not possible because even as the GW report you referenced earlier demonstrated, there is no uniform profile. I don't think narrowing a profile to an average age of 26 and male and U.S. citizen is very much an indicia of an inclination to become radicalized, let alone commit violence. And I do think it's quite problematic legally to base law enforcement decisions on that profile, first because it tends to mistake political viewpoint or religious in intensity with criminality when both of those things are protected. And second, it singles out and stigmatizes this community as particularly vulnerable or prone to extremism when we know that the majority of political violence comes from, you know, white males against abortion clinics, against black activists, et cetera. But the political focus is on the Muslim community in a kind of disproportionate and potentially illegitimate way from their perspective and from a constitutional perspective.
So, William Braniff, what gets you flagged subject to investigation? And do you agree that it's really not possible to predict, or is that, in fact, the objective of the intelligence work?
I certainly don't know what the standards or thresholds are for what gets flagged or what doesn't get flagged as a researcher at the University of Maryland. I would be very surprised if it was political opinions. If so, we wouldn't have 900 investigations, right? The vast majority of the country doesn't like our president or our Congress or some element of our foreign policy at any one given time. I think the threshold is likely much higher than that. And if I could use a corollary example, there's the case of Dylann Roof, a white supremacist who killed, I believe, nine individuals in a church, an African-American church. And as I read newspaper articles about that, there was interviews of a friend and then another friend, or an acquaintance rather, a schoolmate, people who heard him make these violent threats, but they weren't either sensitized to do something about it. They didn't know who to give that information to if they did want to do something about it. And there really wasn't this sort of awareness about, you know, just to take that threat seriously. If that same threat happens online, it's there for the world to see, not just that one acquaintance, but it's there for the world to see. And if that world includes law enforcement organizations or someone else who tips off a law enforcement organization that this individual is making general threats of violence, I wouldn't imagine that a respectable law enforcement community could ignore that.
Okay, very quickly, Dr. Condi, I know you need to leave us and go teach. What will make the Muslim community in the United States have greater faith in the justice system than it does now?
I think it's very simple. It's when we're treated exactly like every other community, when we're not profiled, when we don't have spies being sent into our mosques. When white Christian deranged shooters go and shoot abortion clinics, we don't have lynch mobs going outside of churches. We don't have the FBI, wanting to send spies into churches. People understand there are crazies and loonies in every single faith and ethnicity, and the Muslim community is more than happy to coordinate and cooperate with all law enforcement agencies. We're at the forefront of fighting terrorism, but when we are all treated as a suspect, when we're all treated as a potential fifth column, that's not only insulting and infuriating, it actually buys into the ISIL and Al-Qaeda propaganda, and it actually causes young men to perhaps be more sympathetic. So it is the most counterproductive thing to possibly do.
All right, Dr. Yasser Qadhi, again, professor of Islamic studies at Rhodes College, nationally renowned Muslim cleric. Many thanks for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
And William Braniff, that's a high bar that Dr. Qadhi has set.
I think it's the right bar to set. Muslim Americans are American citizens. They should be treated as such, and I think that should be the end of the story. I wouldn't disagree with the word.
Well, thank you so much for being with us as well. William Braniff, again, Executive Director of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland, expert on countering violent extremism. Great to have you on our program. And finally, with Bahar Azmi, our Legal Director for the Center for Constitutional Rights at Seton Hall, the challenge for law enforcement is pretty clear.
Yes, there's a challenge for law enforcement, and I think law enforcement faces political pressure to respond to these kinds of attacks and show that they're being proactive. But I think they should be mindful both of the constitutional limitations and some worrying historical examples from other conflicts, World War One and the Cold War, where that kind of proactive law enforcement ultimately was counterproductive.
And World War Two, when there was the internment of Japanese, many of them American citizens, who were among those ultimately who went and fought for American interests.
Precisely. Yes, and the Red Scare thereafter, and the sort of targeting infiltration by the FBI and the New York Police Department of, leftist activists,
okay,
et cetera. It's a long story, and we need to be mindful of it.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.